Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast. We're honest-to-goodness network engineers gather in the virtual conference room. We chat about news, work life, and the next big thing coming to your data center. This week, the Pushers are broadcasting from our palatial headquarters, where every office overlooks the ocean, every workstation has its own gigabit internet, and all the caffeinated beverages are in endless supply. And we flew in technical talent from all over the globe for our design discussion this week. So first up, please welcome to the show, Jeff Fry. Jeff, I hope the flight in the Packet Pushers private jet treated you very well, and tell everyone something interesting about yourself.
Yeah, the flight was very good, almost as good as the one I had last week coming from the 50th state. I'm a network engineer at a large enterprise. I take care of the U.S. network for the majority part. Been working on some disaster recovery design with VPN backup for a few of our remote sites. It's fun working with remote people and trying to get them to see how it's supposed to work.
Excellent. We also have with us Kurt Bales. Kurt, the Pushers appreciate you stringing that extra fiber across the ocean floor on your trip over here. We can always use a few more terabits here at headquarters. How are things down under, and what have you been working on?
Going well. I spent a week doing password recoveries on Cisco 3560s. That wasn't fun, especially because I had to walk to every switch.
Yeah, hold the button down. Yeah.
So... No, that was fun because I couldn't send a junior engineer to do it. I had to do it. Just lots of consulting. I've been working on about 5 different projects this week. So
Excellent.
Lots of fun.
Good to have you here. And one more guest. Some say she decrypted a web key using nothing but a calculator watch, and that she turned a 9-slot switch into a 10-slot by stretching the chassis with her bare hands. And all we know... She's called Mrs. Y. Welcome to the show, Mrs. Y. I hope your visit to Packet Pushers headquarters is meeting with your expectations, and tell us all about yourself and what projects are all up in your face this week.
Well, this isn't a bat cave, but it'll do. I'm a senior engineer at a major institution of higher learning. You can think of that what you want. I focus on edge services, network services, network security. I have a background in Unix server engineering and administration. I am busy crushing on Airtight, which is a wireless security company. They've got this sexy way of mitigating vulnerabilities and denial of service attacks, all kinds of things. They're great. And I spent at least 2 days this week punishing a major vendor.
Excellent. Punishing vendors, always a good time.
It wasn't intentional. It's just they were supposed to be technical calls, and I had my list of questions, and they just were dumbfounded by them. So.
And I'm Ethan Banks. I'm a CCIE. I'm a hands-on network engineer. I work for a company that's mid-sized, stretched out over the globe. I work on the WAN and the LAN and so on. This week on the show, we have a main topic we're going to discuss, kind of a design challenge called collapsing layers. We're going to get into the pros and cons of the good old three-layer access, aggregation, and core layer, and then compare that to the emerging architecture that we're seeing more and more, where there's really your data center has been collapsed down to one layer. Before we get to that, we got a few news items from the week that we spotted we thought would be interesting. Jeff, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I spotted a thing called Private Sky. It does email encryption, but based on who's in your circle of trust. So it only works with Internet Explorer right now, but it lets you send encrypted email via email, Facebook, almost any type of application to another person. That as long as they're in your circle of trust, they can decrypt it and read it. So if anybody else tries to read it, they can't. It's almost like the old PGP keys and stuff, yeah. But it does it for a lot easier for people. Just click on a little button in IE, and it pretty much decrypts it or encrypts it, depending on what you got to do.
And it's not just email, right? It's like it looks like Facebook and some other social media is involved in that.
Yeah, as long as I think it uses Internet Explorer, you can pretty much encrypt anything that's text, is what it looks like from what I've been seeing on it, and I installed it and got it working, and it's pretty neat.
Yeah, and free?
It's free for the consumer. It looks like they're going after the businesses for their revenue stream is what I was saying when I was looking at the more of the information.
Well, I'd be interested to know is if it helps. Since it applies to Facebook, does that help us with Facebook privacy and Facebook stealing your stuff on the back end and using it for their evil and nefarious purposes? And I'm guessing somehow no, but...
Yeah, I'm curious what the updates are going to look like when everybody starts encrypting them.
No one's going to encrypt them, though. You know that. I mean, who's going to encrypt them? Nobody. I don't know.
Can we use it for Dropbox?
Doesn't that defeat the whole purpose?
Hey, some of the people I know who are, they say Facebook causes divorce. If your wife can't read what you're sending, maybe it'll save a few marriages.
Yes, but does it work with Dropbox? That's the real question.
Only if Dropbox
I'm not commenting on Dropbox.
Yeah. Now, Mrs. Y, you had a security article you spotted as well, did you not?
Yes, so big surprise, FBI screws up a data center raid. I mean, in the light of what's been going on with InfraGuard, is this any big surprise to anyone? I mean, everybody knows about InfraGuard as well, that all the local chapters are having their websites hacked. So I'm in InfraGuard, right? It's hysterical. So it's this FBI-sponsored security organization. It's not just information security. It's you know, physical security. The fact that their meetings, they always have these, you know, if there's a nuclear holocaust, you know, what's our recovery plan? You know, I never go to those meetings. And
Twinkies.
So, you know, I wasn't really surprised by, oh, they got the wrong servers in this raid and they took out websites. Sites I've never even heard of. I mean, in the article it said something about Pinboard bookmarking site. Have anybody used that? I haven't.
No.
Yet another, you know, dot bomb, I guess. But InfraGuard is kind of interesting because it looks like Lulz targeted all these InfraGuard local chapter sites. So you join the national chapter, and then you get associated with a local chapter in your area. So, you know, if you lived in Wisconsin, you'd get associated with the Wisconsin chapter. And so they've basically been going through, and these sites, apparently, you know, their logins, and you get their little forums. They're okay. And there's some special information. They send out, like, a list of alerts about, you know, what the high threats are and what's, you know, what information has been compromised. I personally haven't found it very valuable, but I think it was more a point of embarrassing the FBI. And so I think, I can't remember, I think Connecticut maybe was hacked, pwned, and they get, oh, and the best part was they took all the members' names and passwords and then they posted them.
Mm-hmm.
Which was, you know, kind of embarrassing, but not, yeah, I'm not that shocked. I don't know. Is anybody else?
What's been bizarre to me, going through all the stories, it seems like everybody's getting hacked. All of a sudden, it's just like hackers are up and they're in the news almost every day with some new site that they've done something with. Either they've grabbed material or they've defaced a site, and they're letting everybody know about it. It's
what if the UK census information was pwned?
Mm-hmm.
What was it? Citibank, 200,000 accounts were compromised.
Yep.
I'm becoming numb. I can't even keep up anymore.
WordPress.org had a break-in.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
What about the FBI taking, just kind of walking into a colo and taking three racks of equipment and didn't quite get it all right is kind of throwing me here.
Really?
Well, that's how I interpreted the story. It says,
I'm looking at
the story in the register, a bungled FBI raid in the data center has taken out an unknown number of websites, etc. It sounds like a bunch of guys in suits and maybe some guns walked in and said, we're taking these. You don't need to know. And then they left.
If it's Patriot, I mean, you know, I mean, where I work, that we get subpoenas all the time. We get requests for information and, you know, data. And, yeah, it's they expect you to comply. And sometimes they come without warrants. And in the past, some people have been more cooperative with that than others here. But
I think the funniest thing at the end of the Register article, they say, the story doesn't say which one of Digital One's data centers was targeted. The 285,000 square foot core site facility was located in Reston, Virginia, and promoted under the slogan "Your data in a safe place." An FBI holding facility is also a safe place, but regrettably not an accessible one. I love it.
Yeah, good time.
Oh.
The FBI. I mean, so much stuff. Dropbox, what was the 4 hours? You could look at anybody's data. You could log into anybody's account. Dropbox. Oh, they hacked. Did you see they cracked quantum cryptography?
Yep.
Yeah, I saw that one.
Yeah. It's just been a great month, I think, for... Just, it's just the emperor really has no clothes. I don't understand what we're doing anymore.
Kurt, does the Australian Stock Exchange know what they're doing?
Well, I was reading this the other day with one of the engineers, and basically they're rolling out their new data center to open up in October, and they're looking to provide equal service to all members of the stock exchange or all participants, to the point where they've got a data center they're building which is about 60 meters across. So to provide a consistent service to all customers of the stock exchange, every single customer will get the exact same length of fiber run to their rack. Even if they're in the next rack over, they'll get a 60 meter run of fiber to ensure that everybody gets a mathematically accurate delivery of the packets.
Which is crazy, because, so, I mean, you're talking about changing the length of a piece of fiber off the cable. We're talking, you know, microseconds of difference before that burst of light gets from one end of the cable to the other. I mean, does it really make that big a difference? I mean, it must.
Flash trading, right? That's what they're focused on. That's what they're gearing it towards, right?
The Australian Stock Exchange last year averaged about $5.5 billion a day. Now, I'm not the one to do the maths, but there's a fair amount of dollars that are passing through every second, or at least if they were dropped, I'd be happy to pick them up. But I know in the early 80s, a stock exchange here rolled out a WAN solution based out of Sydney out to all the customers, and it became a really big thing here that customers in the Sydney city were getting fast access to data, and people on the outskirts and the remote places were complaining that that data was taking longer to get to them and they were ill affected. So I guess the stock exchange has a long memory and are trying to cope with that.
Well, it sounds like the ultimate arbiter of fairness. Hey, we're giving you guys the same length of fiber optic cable. Call over your equipment right here, and we're not even going to mess around with the difference of a foot or a meter of cable in between the cabinets. Everybody gets the same length. If I don't know how you could complain at that point, I guess.
Well, isn't that there was a 60 Minutes story in the U.S. about certain firms having, because of their physical propinquity to the systems, you know, they were located in the same facility and they had, you know, closer connections. So when it came to high frequency trading, they had an advantage. I mean, I'm sure that's why that was probably the motivator. Is that fair?
Well, I was going to say, everybody got stuck on what she was saying when Mrs. Weiss said propinquity, and we're all diving for dictionaries now. And just for the listeners, it's the state of being close to someone or something, proximity. There we go. All right. Thanks. Now I've cleared the air now. We can all move on.
Modern, I'm sorry.
No, it's good. Makes us all smarter. Now, what do you say? We ready to get into the main event here and talk about collapsing layers a bit? You know, the data center that many of us have worked on has very often been three layers. You've got a core layer that's the typically big iron routers that sit in the middle of your network. They handle getting data from one section of your network to another. It's a major junction point for segments of the network, if you will, to connect to one another. Up from that, you'll have an aggregation layer. That's usually, again, another router for everything within a particular segment. And then one layer up from that would be your access layer. That's usually the switch that you've got in a closet or the switch that you've got in a rack that is uplinking your actual hosts. Access layer, aggregation layer, core layer, we're all pretty used to that model of doing things with different variations. You may be thinking to yourself, my network doesn't look like that. Well, sure, fair enough. And actually, that's part of what we're talking about here, because what we're seeing now, particularly with a lot of the newer data center designs, is we're seeing this model of these three layers and thinking in terms of these three layers and where we leverage in services and where we put a firewall and so on. And it's changing now, where things are becoming really one layer is what the vendors seem to be driving us towards. Cisco with their Nexus gear wants to sell you a fabric extender instead of a switch now to put in top of rack or end of row if you're building out a larger data center. I was reading up on Juniper Q Fabric, and they've got a switch that they want it to be part of the fabric, and all of the switches work together as one great big switch. They're changing things so that it's more like one switch and one layer instead of three different layers. So I want to hear from you guys. What do your networks look like, and what are you thinking about for the future, and what's driving those things? Jeff, where are you guys at right now?
Well, last year I actually put in a pair of Nexus 7000s at one of our bigger data centers to try to start using more of the 10 gig functionality that it gives us. Unfortunately, most of my server guys are still stuck in the 1 gig world, so I still have some switches that they're plugging into until they're ready for 10 gig. But once they're ready for 10 gig, they're going to go right to my Nexus core, because it's a lot less cabling and it's a lot easier to manage.
So ready for 10 gig meaning probably like a blade center, some kind of consolidated server infrastructure like that? Or are we talking
We're talking blade centers and stuff. Right now they got a rack of 1 and 2U servers running VMs with all 1 gig connections, and it's a lot of switches and a lot of cables for a little bit of bandwidth. So hopefully we can get to a 10 gig and start collapsing it down to make management a lot easier of the whole solution.
But today on your VM clusters today, they're all just multiple 1 gigs up to some kind of an access layer switch that's top of rack?
Yep, top of rack switches, a whole bunch of 3750s, stacks and non-stacks. Where it's running iSCSI, I pretty much stick with 1 gig switches and let the iSCSI run on that and try to keep it isolated where I can.
So if the 3750 then is your access layer, you're backhauling it to the 7000s?
Yeah, a lot of them are the X series, so they have the 10 gig back. So mm-hmm. I run them 10 gig back to my core. Yeah. This way I keep a few cables in the Nexus 7000 and try not to have a boatload of 1 gig cables.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're really doing, I guess you would say, it's kind of a, you know, an access layer and then a combined aggregation core layer with all that functionality is kind of rolled into your 7000s.
That's a fair statement.
Yeah. Now, in future, are you looking at, you know, what are you looking at taking advantage of in the Nexus line? I mean, are you buying into what Cisco's selling as far as the FEXs and that kind of stuff? And what do you think about all that?
Yeah, we're looking at FEXs for a lot of this stuff, because you can get the 10 gig FEX and run 40 gigs back and stuff like that. My biggest concern right now is they still want to run the vSwitch within their VM cluster, and I'm a little bit leery of trusting the server guys with a switch. So I'm trying to lean them towards a Nexus 1000V so I can have some visibility and start setting it up and making sure we're not going to have loops or anything else. So they're not going to go, "Ooh, look at this. Let me plug a cable in here," and go, "Uh-oh, what happened?"
It's okay to trust him, Jeff. We're all one big happy family now. Everything's going to be fine.
Thing is, they call me when they break it.
Yeah.
We're one family, but they're sitting at the special table.
It's always an hour. Problem.
until we prove them what their problem is, they can go fix it.
Well, Kurt, you're in the consulting business and see all kinds of different networks. What are your customers dealing with now, and what are you advising them to move towards on the opportunities where you're doing data center design stuff?
Well, one of the big things that we've had is that the three-layer model that we were all taught was A, dealing with the shortcomings of spanning tree and redundant paths and all of that. But it also gave us the added benefit of economies of scale. And if I had a switch full of 1 gig ports and then a 10 gig uplink, it was the uplink ports that you could scale in a single direction. But moving towards more of this east-west traffic, and people have this, in my mind, this concept that, well, now that I've got layer 2 multipath coming, I can sort of cable my switches in any which way and, you know, it'll just magically work itself out. And still trying to convince people that there still should be an aggregation layer of, your top of rack switches or your server switches, still getting your multipath, but going through some central devices to I guess funnel your traffic across links that you can scale more effectively. The other thing is, I guess north-south traffic is never going to disappear when you've still got end users, because they're not necessarily plugged directly into your data center.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been advising some customers that in the data center component, yeah, collapse and everything, but anywhere where you've got access users, I mean, the theory originally was also that, you know, you'd do layer 3 on the distribution and you'd do quas on the access, and if you start to collapse all of that into one switch, make sure your switch is capable of handling all of that.
Which brings up a whole different set of problems. I mean, and you were talking about north-south versus east-west traffic as well. When you're talking about that server-to-server traffic, that could be, let's say vMotion. You got a couple of different VMware clusters. You're going to vMotion your traffic from one side of the data center to the other, from one set of switches to the other, east-west traffic, something like that. Man, where do you put in your security and your controls and all that that kind of stuff? And exactly right, you end up with a need for a device that does everything, or having to take your security layer and kind of move it out to somewhere else, and so you end up with was it VMware's got their security gateway, and Cisco's got a security gateway that they'll just layer right into the VMware and push it all the way out to the edge, because kind of where else you're going to put it? Nothing is really centralized anymore, where you can guarantee you're going to shove a bunch of traffic down into a particular place.
Are you talking about VShield? Filter. Are you talking about VShield and the VMSafe API? The only reason I ask is because that's one of the things that I'm working on that caused some humiliation for a vendor recently. It makes sense if you're collapsing down and which means you're flattening out and you're trying to get rid of that. Every time we've got a tenant, we've got to create a VLAN. Every time we want to segregate, we've got to create a VLAN. It's tiring. How many VLANs do you end up with then? If you flatten out and you're in a virtualized environment, if you're not in a virtualized environment, you can start looking at zoning and one of them is PVLANs and stuff. But with VMware has that VMSafe API, and there are a couple of vendors like Altor and Reflex that have that hook into that API, or you have VShield, and they all work at their driver in ring zero of the hypervisor kernel. So it's very efficient. A regular firewall isn't going to work in that situation.
Now, when you're dealing with multiple tenants, are you building virtual networks out for them? So not only is it a VMware sort of environment, but now it seems to be very trendy for multi-tenant environments to have the same physical hardware, but a different virtual network that you provision for your tenants on top. So they're all segregated in that way because you virtualize their network space.
Well, we had just started. We're just starting to look at that. What we had been doing is, as an EDU, we offer co-location to other nonprofits, and we were giving them their own network, their own rack. I mean, it was physically segregated. It might be on our IP space, but that's it. It's like a separate VLAN.
So if you were to do that in the past, you were talking about having to provision a different VLAN out for everybody, and private VLANs. Was that your standard way that you'd approach it?
Yeah. And it's just not, as you start virtualizing, because in most universities, how it works is you're decentralized. Our relationships with departments are, we have SLAs with different groups, and they, will co-locate with us. It sounds very weird because it's one enterprise, but it isn't. We're actually kind of an ISP for our students and with certain departments, and then we're an enterprise for a lot of our administrative staff. So it's very schizophrenic, and this is where we've got to have absolute flexibility, and it, then in that environment, it becomes even more difficult to insert security.
which then leads you to, we need to push this out to the edge.
Yeah, but, you know, what's the edge? You know how many uplinks we have to the internet, you know? So if you're I2, there are multiple research networks out there, you know, there's the energy one. There's, you know, you have, you aggregate, you could have anywhere from 2 to 6 or 7 gig, depending on what institution you are. So how do you deal with that? You know, so you're going to have perimeter control. That's why 10 years ago we collapsed our infrastructure, our network, because it just made more sense for us. We ran fiber everywhere. We couldn't handle having, you know, we already have almost 30 hub sites, and they're not in optimal places. In fact, there's one, we would have situations where it's in the basement of this dorm, and it's older, and a facilities guy accidentally, you know, he props open the door so it doesn't get optimal cooling, and, you know, the air conditioner goes off, and then the switch melts. So there's another one we have where it's the hub site's too close to the laundry room, and so the lint clogs up the condenser, and it overheats, and somebody calls facilities and says, "Hey, you got to go clean out the condenser. Our switch room's overheating." And I don't know if you've ever worked with facilities and, you know, in a large organization that has a separate facilities group. And it can be challenging to communicate to them, "That's a $40,000 switch. You need to get over there."
Yeah, yeah.
So, that's the kind of challenges we have. If we don't have optimal hub sites and we're spread all over, we're a city university, we're spread all over, you know, do we really want a distribution layer?
So, you know, one of the things that was beat into our heads in the old paradigm was how to make all of this redundant. You know, I mean, Kurt, maybe you mentioned spanning tree, or it was Jeff. Someone mentioned spanning tree earlier on, which was we'd build, you know, redundant links into our different layers. And so you'd look at, just to pick somebody, you know, Cisco had a reference white paper that had these diagrams where they said one of their little sayings was build triangles, not squares. So they'd have your two core layer switches, and then going up to your next layer, distribution or aggregation layer, and there'd be, you know, a square and then an X in between them, so every switch was connected to every other one in a ring fashion, and then cross connected as well. When you looked at spanning tree to see what links were actually forwarding, you always ended up with somebody blocking. So you'd lose as much as half of your available bandwidth to forwarding because of the way spanning tree works. Spanning tree prevents loops in the network and does so by each switch in the spanning tree topology communicating messages to one another. And when they determine through those messages where there's a loop, they say, okay, this link's going to be blocked, so I no longer have a loop in my topology. And that's a good thing. One of the links goes away. One of your redundant links, that blocked link, goes active, and now you can use it. We've been using spanning tree to accomplish redundancy on networks like this forever. The complaint being, but I'm, you know, giving away bandwidth. Bandwidth is just sitting there dead, waiting for an accident to happen, for the lint to back up in the condenser and melt a switch down somewhere, and take something offline so I can use that other link. And that's a waste. But it's what we were used to. We use that to build redundancy to each layer. And even, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I was pretty comfortable with a top of rack scenario where I'd have two switches, one that was backhauled to one core, or another that was backhauled to a different core switch, or a stack that was backhauled to both of them in that X fashion, and spanning tree just kind of blocking one or the other to prevent a loop. I mean, is that what you guys were also used to? And is it really as big a deal as we keep hearing from the vendors that spanning trees just got to go away?
I think it's coming down to as well as a 10 gig. I mean, having 10 gig ports in a blocked fashion is a lot of money wasted almost, especially when you start looking at what VMware gives you with vMotion. Suddenly you could be pushing some serious bandwidth. So having block links not available to traffic is could cause problems. I mean, you could oversubscribe a link pretty quick.
I mean, we're using VSS in one of our main campus, and I mean, if you want to watch your security people's eyes roll back in their heads, just use VSS, because then then all their taps, it's like, how do you put all that traffic together?
VSS is in Cisco 6500 virtual switch system, two VSS soups, marry them up together with a special dedicated link that basically extends the backplane between the two switches, and you got one great big virtual switch, only it's two physical ones.
Right, and yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you get more bandwidth and everything, but you get a different set of problems, which, you know, it's because now all of a sudden, then we had to add more taps, or, you know, more inline taps, and we had to, when they want to put traffic back together, it's challenging.
The more inline taps, why? Because you've got, even though it's one virtual switch, you've got two physical switches you're dealing with, so you have to double up your taps?
Yeah, so we've got two 6500s in a VSS configuration, and one's in one building, and one's, you know, all the way in another building, and the taps are in line with each of those switches, you know, but it's now... Before it was, you know, it was HSRP failover. So you knew one was primary and one was secondary. Now the traffic could go either way. So how are they going to, you know, do they have the equipment that can figure that out?
So are you just sending packet copies over to some security device that's just monitoring all the traffic?
Yeah, we have passive taps. We have passive 10 gig taps. I mean, as it is, our NetWitness boxes can't keep up with all the traffic, but I think we can keep a ring buffer of maybe, you know, an hour.
Now, you just spent my brain spinning. Okay, I was thinking about Juniper Q-Fabric, because I just did some reading on it and blogged about it a little bit, because I'm trying to get educated about all the different fabrics that are that the vendors are selling us, and trying to understand exactly how they work. Now, Q-Fabric, the idea is you take a 1U switch that's got 48 10 gig ports in it, and then four other ports that are 10 gig today, be 40 gig someday, backhaul it to... Basically, they're a fabric switch, kind of, only it's passive. It doesn't really have any intelligence. It just allows all of your top-of-rack switches to interconnect and talk directly one to another. And the graphic that they show to illustrate conceptually how this thing works, they just show a ring of switches, you know, 20 of them or so on this ring, every single one having a direct connection to every single other one through this center matrix switch, if you will.
It's just like... the situation with IPv6, it's really sad. Do you know how many devices, security devices out there are not IPv6 aware? So this is the same thing. What usually happens is, networking starts, and you know, I have I have a foot in each domain, and security. I happen to be in networking, but I focus on engineering security solutions. But I'm also in security because that's really my specialty. But I just happen to be placed there in networking. So I have to sort of figure that out. And a lot of the times I'll have to put the stop on things. You know, when we were doing our IPv6 rollout, I said, well, you know, have we really considered this and this and this, Slack attacks, NDP overflows, things like that? Have we considered all these attacks and how we're going to mitigate them? And the guy I report to just went, okay, we have to stop. No, we haven't done that. And that, yeah, people are, what happens is, you know, the technology rolls out, and I don't think a lot of the security ramifications have been considered. And probably, you know, a year from now, the security guys will say, ha ha.
Well, I think the Q Fabric is actually a really good example of that, because what the other vendors are offering, the inter-switch links are still running Ethernet or some kind of encapsulation, but on the Q Fabric, you're going from your top-of-rack switch to your interconnect node, and you can only capture traffic, I guess, on the edge of the device. So you can't necessarily put your wiretap in the middle of the fabric. Yeah, you can only put it on the ingress and egress points.
Yeah, that interconnect device, I haven't seen a tech document on it yet, but my understanding is there's not intelligence there, so to speak. Like it doesn't make forwarding decisions. You know what I'm saying? It just gives the ability for all of the switches that are a part of the fabric to talk directly one to another. And Juniper kept pushing that in the white papers. Anybody can talk to anybody directly.
I mean, isn't this a bit like a Leonardo painting, though, because it's not really finished? I mean, it's like a rough rendering. They're still not ready. I mean,
rumor has it that selected Juniper customers are actually running Q Fabric now, but the unwashed, like the rest of us here, can't buy it yet. We can buy the top of rack switch.
I was thinking it was still vaporware. That's what it sounded like, but maybe it's not ready yet.
It's stronger than that. All the products exist. I haven't heard a product announcement timeline, but I think the interconnect box and the director that you need for the control plane and management bit, I guess, are coming soon. So I am guessing we're going to see it all before the end of 2011, just looking at the way all the product announcements are, all the marketing stuff that they've got behind it. And if it delivers it in reality like they describe it in the white paper, it complicates things for us in ways that we're talking about here, particularly with security stuff.
But there's a reason why we ended up getting service modules for the 6500, right? Getting the firewall modules. Well, no, for exactly this reason. Where do I stick it? Well, I'll just shove it in the middle of the switch.
I can tell you where to
stick
it.
And let the switch work.
Sorry.
You're talking like the firewall services module. You take the firewall services module and let him do the routing for certain VLANs so you can do stateful inspection and apply rules and whatever else you need to do. That kind of thing?
Exactly.
You know, those firewall services modules, they're terrible.
Not for making a profit for Cisco, they weren't.
You're right, exactly. That's what it's all about. We're just like lemmings for their cause. Yeah. I'm wondering, Juniper has the SRXs. I wonder if they'll try to do something similar with those.
Well, I know that we hated on SRXs a couple weeks back, but I love them. My house is running on an SRX 240, but I agree that it's not necessarily a mature product now, but I think it can make the basis of some really interesting integrated devices, especially when it comes to having some of the security aspects in your switching, if you buy into that whole mantra.
Well, I think what's going to happen, and this may actually this could be utilized, I think, in QFabric so Juniper bought Altor. Altor is one of the companies that has the virtualization hook. I'm wondering if they could somehow leverage, and the word is that they're going to integrate Altor into the SRX, the Altor functionality. So I'm wondering if they could somehow leverage that in their QFabric. I don't know. That technology.
It seems possible, but I wonder if we're hitting on something else here. Is Fabric designed primarily this collapsed layer one model where this generic term fabric that's being used? I'm waving my arms around dramatically. I feel like an idiot. Is it really solving a different sort of problem than what we're bringing up all of a sudden? Is it really getting at, hey, we want an easy to manage, very low latency data center so we can move a lot of data around in a hurry, and security is kind of a secondary thing. Oh, you're a super high security environment? Well, maybe Fabric isn't really where you want to go. I mean, is that maybe what we're saying?
I mean, super security. I mean, we're not super security, but, you know, these days, having it's common to have taps and devices hanging off your taps, you know, IDS, having IPS in line. I mean,
I would say it is in a larger environment where people can be thinking about those things. I think in your middle and smaller businesses, I got a firewall, man. I'm secure. It's all good. Firewall's right there. Got that IP any rule there in the bottom. It's all good.
It's don't laugh. There's a university that's done that. It's a little bit of an in-joke. So.
These are the same people that call NAT security, though, right?
Yeah, right. Don't get me started on NAT.
That's why we need NAT and IPv6, because it's security. We can't, yeah, that's why.
La, 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 la.
Make me come over there.
Well, I mean, Jeff, you know, in your Nexus world where you've got the fexes and so on, you can't put a service module in your Nexus 7000. I mean, and that's not even on a roadmap that I've heard about from Cisco at this point. So, you know, how are you thinking about security for your intra data center traffic, if you will?
Well, what we've actually done is we do have some PCI requirements we do have to follow, and actually they're sitting behind an ASA. The Nexus ties into the ASA, and everything sits behind that. It deals with those networks, and it's all firewalled off on that level because it was the easiest way to meet the requirements and make everybody happy. Because you're right, the data center is built for speed and getting data moved from point A to point B within the location.
And then you put that great choke point in.
Yeah, I mean, is that the 10, a big 10 gig ASA then?
Nah, it's a 1 gig ASA. I mean, for the amount of stuff that's actually on there for what we deal with, it was more than sufficient. I think they're using 15 megs of bandwidth on it.
Because if it's PCI, you were dealing with, like, credit card data that's in a stored state. It's not in motion and having to firewall it off, that kind of thing?
Right. It's not quite in credit card data. It's more medical information for some of the HIPAA stuff that we have, but it's got to meet the PCI requirements per the customer.
Gotcha.
So the easiest way to do it was, you know what, the servers you need will go behind a set of firewalls, we'll secure it, we'll write your rules, and everybody goes away happy. But you're right, that was one of the things we had to look at, and that's how we chose to address it, and it met it until there's a better alternative out there.
But as Mrs. White pointed out, it is a compromise in that, now you've got this multi 10 gig forwarding beast sitting in the middle, handing off to a little 1 gig straw in this firewall.
Can these
guys
talk to
each other? Okay, the server's a 1 gig. The server's a 1 gig. What's the difference?
Yeah, I know, but can't these guys talk to each other? It's galling to me that they make these plans. They make, you know, these big, you know, rocking fast pieces of hardware without even considering, our customers are going to have to deal with security. It's just...
Oh, that's all right. Don't worry. HP this week just announced a new module for their E-Series, which goes into one of your switch module ports, and it's a Windows 2008 R2 server. Surely you could install all your security there, right? Maybe install some checkpoint inside your HP switch?
Oh,
sure.
No. Not that name.
Well, okay, another driver here for this whole one-layer thing and fabric, it's not just data. We've all been talking about data security, and IP and IPv6 data is really what we have been focusing on. But all of these new fabrics that are coming out have been, that, from what I've seen, Ethernet. They're Ethernet with maybe some, 40-gig Ethernet soon to be coming to do the interconnects so that you don't have so much oversubscription from the edge. And a lot of this fabric terminology seems to be driven from the storage community, where we're putting FCOE out there. We're going to take our fiber channel, throw an Ethernet frame wrapper around it, and then put it across the wire. So you've got a server with a converged network adapter that's talking 10 gig and sending two different sorts of frames out there, regular old Ethernet and then a fiber channel storage frame with an Ethernet wrap around it, putting it out into the converged fabric, rather than having a regular Ethernet adapter and a regular old fiber channel adapter, each talking to two separate networks. That's part of the equation, part of what the vendors are trying to sell us, is this whole convergence thing. And it isn't necessarily fiber channel that people are doing. I mean, iSCSI's certainly got a huge chunk here as far as what people are actually doing out there in their environments. How does one layer, in your worlds, how does one layer help or not, when you're combining storage and more traditional IP data across that fabric or across that that one layer, if you will. Any of you guys doing storage as well?
Yeah, we are.
What kind?
We fiber channel over Ethernet. iSCSI is still... we don't bridge networks across our data centers, so it could get complicated. I mean, we already have enough problem with NFS. I mean, iSCSI really requires a lossless network, and which would be fine within one data center, but once we have to go across, and of course, that's what the server guys want. You know, you can't tell them no.
You said the magic word, lossless. So yeah. What does that mean in reality for your world? Because as we know, there is no such thing as a lossless network necessarily. Right. You know what I mean? That's a difficult thing to guarantee.
I mean, I don't see... Everybody talks a lot about iSCSI, but what I'm seeing is the resurrection of, and God help us, is NFS. I mean...
You can thank NetApp for that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, SMB is a NetBIOS SMB is a better protocol. I mean, the comparison for me is NFS to me is like a Shih Tzu that needs a haircut and runs into a wall and just can't. It just keeps running into the wall. You know, like I remember when I was Unix server admin, we had these cross NFS mounts on these two sunboxes, and you'd shut one down, and it. You know, and the NFS mounts would die on the other one, and you bring the system back up, and they just couldn't reestablish. Now, I know there's NFS 2 and NFS 3, but I'm still, they don't seem to have improved the protocol that much. And there, you know, and there's not great security in some of these appliances. So, I don't know. But that's what I see everybody going to. It's because it's cheap. You know, the NetApp boxes are cheap.
I think to Ethan's point about lossless Ethernet, the thing to remember with the priority flow control, the way they achieve lossless is by telling
you're getting into data center bridging stuff there, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the way they establish lossless is telling the server that's writing to storage to stop. It's not guaranteeing the flows. It's more along the lines of saying, well, I can't handle it right now. Come back later, even if later is a couple of milliseconds away. And that's another reason for a single hop at this point in time. Like if you've only got a single layer, it's that one device that handles in and out. And until we get some of the end-to-end DCB standards finalized, so end hosts or switches that aren't directly connected can control some of that lossless, we're kind of stuck in a bit of a hell of what do we do, what do we roll out. So,
Jeff, are you combining storage in your environment at all?
Yeah, I mean, all the fiber channel we have is actually still dedicated fiber channel, but yeah. There is some iSCSI, but since that wonderful VM cluster I referred to is all 1 gig NICs, it's actually dedicated NICs for the iSCSI network, so they're actually on their own switches, and the only access we have is management. It's like, here you go, guys, have fun.
So you actually dedicated physical switches for your iSCSI traffic.
Yeah, we actually dedicated 3750 stack, I think it was, of all 1 gig, so I said, here you go, because it only had was 1 gig ports. So, I mean, it's the best way for us to do it and guarantee you for what they needed was to, here's your stack, have a nice day.
Did you do jumbo frames as well?
Oh, we had to do all that fun stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I mean, see, that's interesting because, you know, we're talking about layers and collapsing layers. Okay, that's... You know, the old fiber channel model is the opposite of that. Taking a dedicated set of switches and putting iSCSI on it is the opposite of that. But we have our reasons that we do these things. We want to kind of guarantee that storage traffic isn't on our network so that we don't have to worry about it. So if there's any convergence if there's any... if you get a whole bunch of stuff on a pipe and it can't send anymore, that would be congestion. Thank you. That's been a long day. All right, been a long day. If you get congestion and then that storage traffic's trying to get access to it, and if what if the QoS policy doesn't work quite like you want? And like Kurt was talking about, well, we haven't really got mature data center bridging standards yet, where we can kind of carve up our 10 gig pipes into the appropriate channels and deal with that and so on. boy, then what do you do? You know, we'll throw it all on its own switch, or can't you just keep building out the Fiber Channel network bigger for right now until we get this
whole thing sorted out? Yeah, but you know, an Oracle transactional database is fine with loss, data loss. I'm kidding. That was. I'm sorry. Did I get into too much application specific stuff?
Oracle's always been fun.
Oh yeah.
Well, the sad thing to me is so many applications ride on TCP, which is supposed to be able to overcome that. You know, eventually your payload's going to get there. May not be as quick as you needed it, but it'll get there. You know, storage does seem to be more easily upset about this. But I mean, how many situations have you guys run into where your iSCSI, let's say, was exceeding the output of a gigabit link? You know, it happens commonly in my world. I've been looking at it quite a bit because I'm seeing out discards going on my 1 gig link on my on an iSCSI VLAN. You know, I've got a VLAN that's dedicated for iSCSI. I know that I've got a dish shelf attached to a series of gigabit NICs. There's out discards going on because we got to go in and set flow control on, and can't do that without taking the Ethernet port down. And so at the moment, there's definitely some impact to performance. No one's complaining about corruption to the disk shelves. No one's complaining about I can't read this data off the disk anymore. So how lossless is lossless, I guess, is the question.
Well, the key with iSCSI is that at least there is some control over whether packets did or didn't make it with confirmations. But with Fiber Channel, I'm sending it across the wire and I'm just going to assume that it happened. So in the protocol itself, it's not necessarily checking whether the writes happened. The fact that I sent it is good enough for me to assume it happened, which is why we have to be so lossless.
I gave a chore to my children, and I assume it gets done. No, I don't. So did we come to any sort of an agreement on what we think the storage is supposed to do? I mean, Mrs. Y, you were talking about we're running FCOE. Are you running just one-hop, single-hop FCOE? Is multi-hop FCOE even standardized? I know some vendors are talking about it.
We're doing that. We have a dark fiber ring, and that is we have an FCOE channel, storage channel. So it's one hop. It's not. We're not doing anything sexy with Fiber Channel or Ethernet.
So you're just doing like an FCOE frame into a switch that can cope with it, and then stripping the Ethernet frame header off of it, turning it into Fiber Channel via gateway somewhere, and popping it onto the SAN? Or is everything FCOE?
Everything's FCOE. Everything's FCOE.
You've gone to the dark side.
No, I mean, we've been doing it for a while, so we just haven't. I mean, there's been talk of iSCSI. The problem is we can't overcome the issue of, I mean, you know, you're supposed to move traffic at the lowest, at the cheapest layer, and especially iSCSI, you don't want to have to route iSCSI traffic. You know, that would be the benefit of, you know, collapsing your network so that you can, you know, I mean, how are you going to get lossless? You're not going to route it. But once, you know, and then we have firewalls in between these data centers. Are we really going to try and run iSCSI through that? No. Come on. Yeah.
All right. Let me throw this a different way then. This is really a design discussion. We're talking about different ideas. And, of course, a lot of what we've been talking about is the fact that, well, we've got an existing network with stuff on it, and we're trying to move to this other thing, so how do we get from point A to point B? All right, let's try this. Clean whiteboard. Jeff, you're up. You have the chance to build yourself a brand-new data center, and what are you going to do? What would you recommend?
It all comes down to what my staff can support. I think that's the first thing a lot of us have to look at. But I would love to do FCOE with some storage arrays, but I also know that as maybe a perfect world, but none of us work in it. Reality steps in someplace and says, yeah, how do you support that? And calls in the middle of the night. But to be honest, though, I've been pleased with the Nexus Core that we've had. It's done exactly what we needed to do. It doesn't do Fiber Channel of Ethernet yet. Our server guys aren't ready for that, but we've talked about doing it. I mean, that would be my optimal. It'd be a decent core with a good FCOE storage array, less cabling. Let's make things a lot cleaner out there so it's not a bajillion cables in a rat's nest someplace.
So in other words, you buy into one layer. You've bought into that.
I bought into the one layer minus the fiber channel because you still got to break it out and have a fiber channel network. Just as long as you can run FCOE all the way down to the storage, and most of the ones that are out there, I don't think they all do it yet. So someplace you still got to break it out the fiber channel and have that network for your storage network.
Kurt, would you, if you had a clean sheet of paper to work from, is that kind of how you'd approach it?
Well, that's actually exactly what I'm doing right now. I'm building a brand new data center for a customer where I'm going the single layer inside the data center. I haven't decided which vendor I'm doing it, the data center switching with, but basically coming straight out into a pair of SRX routers, or firewalls, whatever you want to call them today. And as soon as I leave the SRXs, it's basically MPLS across the backbone. I'm not going to deal with anything special, but inside the data center itself, I'm going with a single layer.
Mm-hmm. And so that single layer inside the data center is comprised of what? Well, as much as you can say.
Well, I'm tossing up at the moment between either a Nexus or a QFabric, QFX. But because of the way that the data center is being built, I'm going to have far fewer top-of-rack switches than something like the QFX interconnect node is currently acceptable floor space for. So I'm still working through. The other option is I was looking at maybe just a pair of Nexuses to handle that so I can scale it out in the future with some FEX as required.
5,000s or 7,000s?
For this one, it'll probably be 5,000s to start with, and if the scale grows larger than what was originally planned, then, yeah, 7,000s.
Well, so what about those new little 7,000s supposed to come out with eventually? I mean, there's some of the 9 series that's rumored is not a bad size.
End of July is the rumor I'm hearing for the 7,009s and rumored 7,006s.
Rumored we've
seen slides and part numbers, and it's just a rumor, though. Pictures leaked on Cisco's site. Anyway.
Yeah, because the only thing I could see with running a 5,000 issue is you lose the possibility of, like, OTV and stuff. If you want to start looking at some of the features of the Nexus in a data center and being able to bridge different things. But then again, if you're running MPLS,
well,
you do have
that
some
was
other
why...
options.
Well, I had tossed up using an ASR as the layer 3 border device to the data center where I could do OTV there. But today you still kind of need multicast across your backbone to get most of the benefits of OTV, which this network will have, but that's a different story.
Mrs. Y, did I hear a sharp intake of breath when someone said OTV?
No. We're a hybrid. I mean, when it comes to collapsing, I mean, for us, it's kind of a Greg's trademarked expression, it depends.
Mm.
You know, it's... You know, we've got a lot of legacy stuff, so FCOE is not going anywhere anytime soon. You know, iSCSI has been talked about on and off, but we end up with NetApp. because we have remote sites, well, we treat them like remote sites, but to some degree physically because they're hub sites. I mean, we have users, we have, you know, distance that we have to go to provide uplinks for them. You know, we can't completely collapse.
Well, I think you just hit on something pretty significant there, which is there is no one-size-fits-all design. Every data center is going to have different requirements, and we're going to have to go and look at this and go, well, what's right for here? And the answer is, it depends. Exactly, it depends. You know, in my world, I'm looking at needing to do some collapsing as well. It would be nice if I could get everything so that I have fewer physical devices to manage, whereas right now I've got a mix of a couple of 6500s that sit in the middle of one of the larger computer rooms I'm dealing with, and just a bunch of top-of-rack switches that are going to them. every time someone asks me to provision a port, I got to say, all right, what rack is it in? Where are you plugging it into? And so on and so on. I got to figure out what the right switch is, mm-hmm. get it in the right VLAN. And it would be nice if that could all be consolidated and maybe even automated. As we move to a VMware environment, it'd be nice if we could kind of template this stuff out. Well, I'm putting this in VLAN, 254. Okay, well, you got the template for it. Have a good time. Let me know if you have any problems.
IPv6. I mean, if we not only if we physically flatten out the network, but if we flatten it out to a more of a flat layer 2, then we're not plagued with all these itsy bitsy VLANs all over the place. I mean, especially because of the size of IPv6 subnets, I mean, won't it make more sense kind of with the range of IPs to actually flatten it that way too? Maybe it's complementary.
Yes, yes and no. I mean, there's if we had Ivan on right now, he'd have all kinds of things to say. I know he'd get very excited about this, but
if he were on, I wouldn't talk.
Well, I think the answer again comes down to it depends. Yeah. You know what? We got one listener question that came in on Twitter today when I mentioned on the feed that we were going to talk about collapsing layers, and so here's a guy. He's asking, for a small network, could I run a single 6513 and just have it do everything? Core distribution, access, firewall, for the entire network, even the workstations.
Oh, just one?
Well, that's the question he asked, so let's address it. Why don't you go first?
You never have one of anything.
Yeah.
No, that's just bad, especially what if... I mean, Cisco's always stay up, right? No.
Well, I'll say this for a 6500 and the 4500s, that in a properly configured dual soup arrangement where you've got a true standby hot, you can have a supervisor, an iOS failure, a crash, and have it flip over to the other soup, and most of the time it goes very well. You don't even know what happened. I want to say most of the time. I haven't had a situation where the failovers actually caused me a problem, but I've heard stories, so I want to, knock on wood and all that. For me,
When you corrupt the config, though, and then you've copied it across to your redundant spare.
That doesn't happen.
Wouldn't it make more sense to buy something smaller and have two? Or I don't know. Or buy something, not buy Cisco, if you can't afford two 6513s. I don't know.
Yeah, you could do it. You could take everything and jam it all into a single 6513, and let's assume that you put dual supervisors in it for that, at least that much redundancy. You've still got a huge SPOF. You've still got the backplane of the chassis is a SPOF. Say something catastrophic happens in your dual soup arrangement and your failover doesn't work successfully, or you've got corruption that is mirrored between the two supervisor engines, you're dead in the water. You're not half dead. You're completely dead, which is why I agree with Mrs. Y, and I think everybody here is kind of chuckling and having the same response. Geez, we have two of everything. Yeah. I mean, I'd rather see two 6509s or 06s or something like that as opposed to a single 6513. That said, could you get away with it? Yeah. Would things be okay with a properly stable iOS and you're not doing too many exotic features? You could probably get away with it. Would I recommend it? No, never. I never would do that.
Just the one time. It only takes one. It only takes one really nasty little outage to leave you out the door.
I'm just thinking blade failures, too. I mean, that's a lot. If anything fails, it's a line card. It's pretty big failure, too.
It's also a lot.
But at least
you
know where to go to fix it. It's all in the one box.
Yeah, but it's all 1 gig ports with workstations. I'm sure the cabling's perfect, too, on those things.
Well, okay, what if there's nothing wrong with the blade, but your fan card goes in your 6513? The way the cabling works on that, it's unless you've cabled very carefully, it's almost impossible to get those stupid fan cards out of there because you got a bunch of cables in the way, and the whole fan card, the fan tray runs the whole length of the chassis. So, yeah, that fan card goes away. The thing shuts itself down because it's about to go into thermal overload. Again, you're completely dead in the water. You split it between two different switches. then if one switch goes bad, you've at least got the other switch to continue on with.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he made another point here, which was, you know, your entire network, including workstations. Would you ever put a workstation and a server on the same switch?
Well, I guess let's even step back. He's mentioned 6513 specifically, but mm-hmm. let's go product neutral. My response to collapsing the core is collapse the core where it doesn't compromise redundancy and subscription and contention. When you're plugging your workstations in, if they're in a separate line card, for example, that's already oversubscribed and it's already limited to the backplane or the fabric, maybe that's acceptable. Would I plug it into the same line cards that my servers are on? Probably not.
For sure. I mean, every line card in that chassis is going to have a certain amount of bandwidth that's allocated to it. You plug it in, it doesn't have infinite bandwidth. It's got whatever the card is capable of. And if I know you went vendor neutral, Kurt, but just to speak to the 6500 specifically, depending on what card it is, you've got a different amount of backplane aggregate bandwidth that's going to be available to that line card. On the biggest and the best, where you've got dual fabric attached, it's I believe it is 40 gig. You've got two 20 gig connections into the fabric, like a 6700 series. But you go down the line to some of the older ones, the classic cards, I forget how low it goes, pretty low. Yeah, it gets real easy to blow the back out of one of those cards. It just doesn't have the packet for it.
And what if you create a loop? What if you accidentally, somebody does something stupid with a switch off of one of those ports? I mean,
that's what the clue
then you take
for.
Down your four. I mean,
yeah, I mean, I hopefully there'd be, you know, root guard in place and, you know, BPDU guard in place and these things that would prevent that. But as you say, what if? Because that...
You can always... We miss stuff all... it happens. You miss stuff all the time or...
My favorite loop story involves someone who had plugged a patch on one wall into a patch on the other wall but you couldn't tell looking at the rat's nest of cable under their desk. You had to pull all the cables apart. He was trying to figure out why, you know, BPDU guard had shut down this port on the wall. And that's when I traced it all out to figure out what the heck had gone on. That's what it was. He'd plugged in one wall into the other, the switch into itself, and the switch had, you know, shut the port down because it saw the BPDUs coming in from spanning tree. It's like, oh man, you just can't count on what people are doing. You'd have no idea what goes on out there.
And then have you ever seen, we've had HP printers do like broadcast that do a multicast storm once in our library. I don't think we ever figured out why it happened, but can you imagine if, say, you have some just crazy device that goes insane, like a sonic wall or an HP printer, and it's plugged into your core.
Or just as you would think, a malicious user who wants to sit there and blast things. I mean, because he could neighbor up if you're running any routing protocols potentially.
Yeah, you know what? If you get somebody who just wants to be nasty, they can just create a massive denial of service. But then he's taking down your entire core.
I actually found a guy who was doing ghost multicasting, so I was running storm control, and the multicast storm control was tripping, and I called into the office to find out what was going on. And are you by any chance running ghost image machines with multicast? Why, yes, I am. Oh, okay.
Good times.
I've also been in the case where they were doing ghost multicast, and it was a Cisco 877 was the layer 3 device. And even though it wasn't going through the router, the fact that there was a bridged wireless and the switch ports on an 877 can only handle about 9 meg of traffic and kept rebooting the router every time someone ghosted.
I guess what we're saying is, yeah, you could, but you don't want to. There's a lot of reasons not to do what you're talking about doing. I mean, if it's... if you're just trying to save money or, you know, rack space or whatever, there's reasons you have to do certain things. But if this is, let's just design this, you really want to split things out between two physical devices at least would be what we're all saying, you know, at the minimum. So, well, that was a good discussion. I don't think we fixed anything, but we had a lot of good discussion about what's going on out there now.
We got to use it depends.
Yes, we absolutely did. Kurt, tell us what you're going to be doing this week and where we can find you on the interwebs.
Yeah, I can be found on Twitter as @networkjanitor or on my blog at www.network-janitor.net. This coming week is going to see some more study for my Juniper JNCIE lab. I've got some more consulting and network audits to run where I'm building the network maps as I go. And probably a little more hating on Cisco stock photography people.
Jeff, you're up, man. How can we find you on the internet, and what you up to this week?
On Twitter, you can find me at fryguy_PA, or on my blog site at www.fryguy.net. And this week is actually going to be me starting to get ready for Cisco Live in a few weeks. I noticed the presentations were up there, grabbing them, and I'm working on a shirt for me and one of the other guys out there that kind of plays off the keynote speaker, William Shatner, with some of the Cisco gear. So I'll have more information on that later, but we're having some fun right now.
I definitely don't hate you even at all just because I'm not going to Cisco Live. I mean, no hate. I mean, I'm good with it. I've come to terms, and I'm, you know, going to cry myself to sleep because I'm not going this year. Mrs.
I'll drink
Y.
some free beer for you.
Mrs. Y, what can you tell us in your secretive identity about what you're going to be doing this week? Because I don't think we can find you on the interwebs anywhere. Unless we're being hacked, then we know maybe it's you. But
no, I only use my... my knowledge for good. I'm going to be continuing to work on investigating virtualization and firewalls. I think the time has come, but the vendors really haven't solidified what they're doing, and sometimes they don't tell you the truth when they can't do it what you want. So I'm working on that and exploring wireless IPS. That is a big... that's a big problem for us, mitigating those kinds of threats, because we have publicly broadcast SSIDs, and there are a lot of bad guys out there.
That sounds like a whole other show all by itself.
It's really, by the way, a Gartner report on wireless IPS comes out apparently. Not that anybody... But apparently that's a lie. So, and that's supposed to be causing a lot of there's going to be a lot of
magic quadrants.
Yeah.
We got an "and it depends" and a Gartner reference.
Yeah,
that's good.
There might be some negative fallout from that. Because what I'm finding is that, first of all, it's kind of ironic. I'm finding that a lot of these vendors, they sell wireless equipment, and they don't seem to know that much about it. And they also don't, they sell wireless IPSs, and they don't really understand the attacks. They don't know how to mitigate them. It's like, well, we can send an alert. Okay, yeah.
What they know is how to get you to sign on the dotted line. That is what they know.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm learning what I'm learning from this experience is how to make sales engineers cry.
A worthy goal.
Oh, well, my name is Ethan Banks. I am at EC Banks on the Twitter, and you can find me also on my blog at packetattack.org. And thank you for listening to Packet Pushers this week. You can follow Packet Pushers at packetpushers.net, and also on Twitter at Packet Pushers. Thanks for listening this week, and we will see you next week with another design show. We got some stuff from Juniper coming up. We're going to talk to Juniper about QFabric. We're going to be talking about designing a secure internet-facing application, all the things that are caught up in that. We got a show planned about how to make forwarding decisions in your router by completely ignoring the routing table. And we also are going to talk at some point about using the internet as a WAN failover. So if your private WAN is broken, how to use the internet to back that up. We got a lot of good stuff coming, so stay subscribed to the podcast. Go up on iTunes and leave some good comments. It helps us and helps build the show. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, everybody.